Morning, Penguin Radio. This is Real Life, and this is DJ Homeschool. It is Wednesday, October 29th, and it is a beautiful, crisp fall day here at Dominican. It's nice and foggy. That Bay Area fog is starting to roll in, and it makes me so happy. It's freezing cold. I actually slept in sweatpants, and usually I sleep in shorts because I get so hot at night, but it's cold and I absolutely love it. I had an awesome night last night. I babysat the twins and I took them out to dinner and we had a really fun night. And then I went over to my friend Bella's house and I was practicing my show. And, you know, I was rehearsing and running a couple things by her, and she thought that it would be fun if I opened up the show today with a fun fact, and she was just sitting there laughing to herself, and I was like, what is she laughing at? What is so funny? And she's like, okay, you need to open your show with this fact, that New Yorkers bite more people than sharks every year. More people suffer, like have to go to the hospital from New Yorker bites than from shark bites. So we both thought that was kind of entertaining and funny. And so we thought it would be a good little show opener. So I'm going to do a special episode of Real Life today. And it's because this Saturday, November 1st, is World Diabetes Day. And I love World Diabetes Day. It's no secret that I'm a type 1 diabetic. I have been for the past 18, almost 19 years. And so it's obviously a huge part of my life. And I've talked about it on various broadcasts of Real Life in one way or another, whether it's, you know, how drinking soda affected my blood sugars and what eating right does for me. Remember my show All on Quinoa? That was all, you know, talking about diabetes and keeping good blood sugars, drinking lots of water and staying active. And so it's been a bunch of different things. But today I kind of want to take a little bit of a break from the normal schedule. And I want to share my diagnosis story with you. And this is something that is a very emotional part of my life, but it's been probably, if I had to say what's been the most influential part of my life, it would be my diagnosis with type 1 diabetes. Now, of course, I don't remember. I was 2 years old. I don't remember the series of events. I don't remember the actual diagnosis and going to the hospital and meeting with doctors and so on and so forth. But what happened thereafter, you know, the effects of diabetes on my life, I really find it very empowering. And that sounds like a funny thing, like, okay, why is a disease either A, why is it a positive for you? Or B, how do you make diabetes empowering? And to be honest, it has been a struggle for me throughout my life, and it will continue to be. And especially for my parents, you know, I would be so wrong if I didn't take the time out of the show to thank them. My dad's at work and my mom is at a conference in Chicago right now. And so they're not listening, but they'll listen to the podcast later. And I need to thank them because it sounds dramatic, but if it weren't for them, I wouldn't be here. If it weren't for their attention to details, to their little girl and to my health and, you know, throughout my whole life helping me manage my diabetes, I wouldn't be at a great school and getting a degree and playing golf and having this radio show here on air with you guys this morning. And it really has been an event that my whole family has taken part in. My aunt and uncle, you know, they're amazing. My aunt is actually, she's listening right now and she has type 1 diabetes as well. And so that's something that she and I always bond over. You know, when there's low blood sugars, we're like, oh my gosh, I just ate 5 bags of Skittles. What did you eat? And so that's something that she and I have been able to bond over throughout my life and through her experience with diabetes. And of course, all my grandparents have really stepped up. You know, no one expects when they're getting their grandchildren to come over that they're going to have to weigh and measure all their food and give them injections or change their pump site or wake up in the middle of the night to check their blood sugars. But they've really taken that responsibility and just they've all helped shape me into who I am. And so I just wanted to thank them because they're just the most amazing. I mean, everyone thinks their family is amazing, but I think they're extra amazing just for that. So really, diabetes has been this influential, empowering, family bonding sort of experience for me. And it really has shaped me into who I am. You know, I've learned from this. I've grown from this. I've absolutely been challenged. I've given up at times, you know, not for very long because it's not an optional thing to take care of. But, you know, you give up and then you just get right back up again. And I've spent a good portion of my life learning about diabetes and managing diabetes. And now the twins, you know, Sebastian, I know I've said this before, Sebastian is diabetic as well. And so now I get to kind of do the role reversal and I get to be the diabetes caretaker and kind of see where everyone was coming from when I was a young child, you know, checking those blood sugars and being extra cautious because little kids' blood sugars spike and go really, really high or go really, really low a lot faster than an adult would. And so I want to take some time today and talk to you about my journey and how I kind of ended up here and what it means for me to be diabetic and talk about my diagnosis story. So, you know, no one likes getting shots. No one wants to be, you know, getting medicine in their body every day. You know, that's what diabetics have to do. They have to get insulin in their body every single day. And so just imagine being poked by needles at least 5 times a day. And that's just to stay alive. You know, I give myself at minimum 4 shots a day. And then I check my blood sugar at minimum 6 to 8 times a day. And that's the minimum. That's if I have a very calm, nothing's really changing. But on days where I play golf or I'm, you know, going to San Francisco and, you know, walking around a lot, it, you know, the number goes up. So you got to check more, be more cautious. And so the fact is that, you know, these needle pokes and medicine injections, that's my reality. But there really is a lot more to it. So I'm just really excited that I get to share this with you guys today. And I want to talk about a quote. And I did a little bit of research. You know, I love getting on different diabetes websites. And I'm a part of a couple of Facebook groups and, you know, things of that nature. And so I want to open with this quote. And it's from the chairman of the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, Mary Tyler Moore. And she says that both children and adults, like me, who live with type 1 diabetes, need to be mathematicians, physicians, personal trainers, and dietitians all rolled into one. We need to constantly be factoring and adjusting, making frequent finger sticks to check blood sugars, and giving ourselves multiple daily injections just to stay alive. And so that quote really resonated with me because it just sounds all too familiar. That is essentially what you do. You are checking your blood sugar. You're giving yourself insulin. You're factoring carbohydrates and proteins and fats. You're adjusting the levels of your insulin to carbohydrate ratios. So you have to do that math. You have to, you know, be prepared to change the sites or if you, you know, a little poke gets infected, you have to be able to deal with that. You obviously have to keep up on your fitness and your health and doing the personal training and the dietitians, you know, all of that. And so it's a lifestyle. It really is a lifestyle. And according to the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, approximately 3 million Americans have type 1 diabetes. And a lot of people don't realize that. They don't think that many people have it. And so let me break that down a little bit further for you. So around 80 people per day get diagnosed with type 1. That's approximately 15,000 people a year. And for those of you on Dominican's campus, I'll break this down a little bit further for you. It's about 4 times the number of students that actually go to our school. So it's a lot of people. And there is definitely confusion about diabetes and the differences between type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes. And type 1 is an autoimmune disease where a person's pancreas, like mine, stops producing insulin. And insulin is a hormone that enables people to get energy from their food. And because it doesn't work because the immune system attacks and destroys the insulin-producing cells within the pancreas. And so we do still all keep our pancreases. Is that the plural of pancreas? Pancreases? Pancreae? Anyways, we, all of us diabetics, still have our pancreas because it does a lot of other things besides just produce insulin. So it's fine to stay in our bodies. It just, that little part of it just doesn't work. So type 2 diabetes is a metabolic disorder. Has to do with your metabolism. And it can be hereditary. And you're a person's body, when they have type 2 diabetes, they still produce insulin, but their body is unable to use it effectively. And type 2 diabetes is usually diagnosed in adulthood, while type 1 is usually diagnosed in your childhood. However, my aunt is a prime example of how that's just not true. She was diagnosed in her 30s. And so it can vary, but primarily it's a childhood development. And it's even known as juvenile diabetes often. So type 2, more adults, not a lot of kids are going to be diagnosed with it. And it doesn't always require insulin injections. And it's, in certain instances, based on severity, it can be regulated with diet and exercise. So insulin for type 1s is a necessity. Insulin for type 2s, it's kind of on a little bit of a scale. So people with type 1 obviously must inject insulin somehow in their body every day. And they have to account for every morsel of food that they put into their mouth, check their blood sugar constantly, and go to a number of doctor appointments. And, you know, the main one is the endocrinologist, and they're the people that are trained diabetes doctors, if you will. And another one that I go to, I have to go to the podiatrist and the ophthalmologist. And this is just all to, you know, ensure optimal diabetic health. And type 1 diabetes accounts for $14.9 billion per year in healthcare costs. So, you know, prescriptions and doctor's appointments and insulin and, you know, all that stuff. It's $14.9 billion. That is a lot of money. And I feel really lucky because, you know, to have insulin. You know, I'm reading this book right now, and it talks about the discovery. It's talking about the discovery of insulin and the first person to ever be on insulin. And she's actually a woman. And it saved her life. She was dying. They didn't think there was anything else they could do for her. And the scientists, I haven't gotten too far into it, but the gist of it is that these scientists created insulin and they did it as a trial. They thought, you know, maybe we can help her. You know, maybe this fake, you know, this genetically modified lab produced drug will be able to mimic what your body naturally produces. And sure enough, many, many years later, here we are. And I know this is something that is amazing to me, is that in the short time that I've been alive, you know, 20 years, I have even seen insulin changes. You know, at first, when I was first diagnosed, shots were not the way to go. You know, shots were very difficult. And now shots are a really commonly used, you know, injections were a really commonly used diabetes practice. I'm on injections. My aunt's on injections. My cousin is actually diabetic, and I'm pretty sure she's on injections as well. And so, you know, there are a bunch of different ways to manage it. You know, insulin, the technology has just greatly intensified and gotten so much better. And so I have a lot of faith in the healthcare system when it comes to diabetes care. So it's been a really great experience. So, you know, while it's not a cure, it is necessary to prevent, you know, diabetes side effects. And the sad part is diabetes does come with a handful of side effects. And, you know, to name a few, we, meaning the diabetic community, we are really prone to kidney failure. And we're also at a 50% higher risk of heart attack and stroke. And for women, we're really at risk for high-risk pregnancies, and for males, sexual performance issues. Side effects that I personally suffer from, I have some vision problems, absolutely, and I have a little bit of nerve damage in my hands, on my fingertips mostly, from where I've checked my blood sugar so many times over the years. And so that's something that, you know, I've gotten little calluses, and I don't have a whole lot of feeling in a couple of spots on my fingertips. So, you know, no big deal, perfectly livable. And the one thing I do want to clarify is that for me specifically, and any other diabetic out there, these are not due to negligence. These are the simple, it's the name of the game. It's what happens, especially if you've lived with it as long as I have and continue to live, you know, a good, healthy life. It's still a possibility. So I want to get started here and talk about my diagnosis story. Now that you have a little bit of diabetes background, I'm going to go ahead and tell you, you know, I did have this conversation. You know, I don't remember this. I know the story. I've heard it a million times. My mom has written for a couple newspapers, you know, they've published a story on it. And, you know, I talked to her over the phone a couple nights ago, and we had a really good long talk about that diabetes diagnosis story. And it's amazing to me because she remembers still such small details and, you know, times that we, you know, that certain events happened and who was where and when and what area we were in the house when she noticed this part of me, you know, not feeling so well, or, you know, it was just amazing how much she still remembers. I mean, I love the woman, but she can't remember what she had for breakfast yesterday. And so it's just amazing to me. We always joke with her about how bad her memory is. She'll be the first to admit it. But it's great that she still remembers this and was able to have a good long conversation with me and kind of share these memories and this story so I could share it with you. So it began, it was 1996. My little baby sister was only 4 months old at the time, and I was 2. And mid-April, I started wetting the bed. And I had been potty trained for over a year. And, you know, I'd been going to the bathroom and the toilet since I was 10 months old. And, you know, it was really once I started walking, and I started walking at 9 months old. And so I had to be put, my mom and dad had to put me back into diapers at night. And she thought, okay, you know, this is a little bit weird, but, you know, it's my first baby. And so, you know, I'm not really sure. I'm just going to kind of let it happen. And it was really hot. You know, we're from Arizona and it was April. And so, but it's already getting quite warm outside. And so I was really thirsty. And so my mom was letting me drink a lot, you know, during the day. She was giving me juice, like 100% juice. And I would just wet the bed every night at least once. And so she kind of just all connected it. You know, she thought, okay, you know, juice, peeing the bed, no big deal. It's hot. I'm not going to make too big of a deal of it. But it started going on for weeks. And then I started to develop this really weird rash on, like, the back of my legs and my butt. And she thought, again, all connected, diaper rash, drinking a lot, peeing a lot, sitting in her diaper in bed, you know, that's what it's from. Of course, later she would go on to find out that these, in fact, were signs of diabetes, but at the time, she truly had no idea. So this went on for a couple weeks, and then it was on May 4th, and I really started, that's the first signs that they knew that I really wasn't feeling well. And my mom's really good friend was over, and her name was Jennifer, and we were playing, and I walked over to Jennifer, I kind of motioned for her to like pick me up, and so she grabbed me, I was sitting on her lap, and I just threw up everywhere, all over her. And again, they really didn't think it was that big of a deal. They thought, oh no, poor baby, you know, this is why she wasn't feeling well today. You know, she must have a tummy bug. And my parents have never been super germophobic. It wasn't a big deal to them. You know, they just cleaned me up, cleaned Jennifer up, and then they remembered me just getting right back down and going to play again. I was completely fine. So that was May 4th. So the next day, May 5th, and I was a little bit more lethargic. And they thought I was just starting to recover from a little bit of a tummy bug. And they knew I was getting sick. And, you know, but it's not uncommon. Little kids get sick. You know, they're going around, they're playing with their friends. We went to play groups and parks and, you know, we did a lot of stuff. And it, getting sick is natural. People get sick. That's just how it goes. Didn't think anything of it and just kind of, you know, helped me try to recover. So the 6th of May, I was not moving. I had gotten progressively worse and I was starting to get really, really sick. I was not getting out of bed. I didn't want to walk around. I didn't want to talk. I didn't want to do anything. And for those of you that know me, that just doesn't ever happen. Unless I am super sick, I'm never just laying around in bed or doing nothing. I didn't even want to read books, and that was my favorite thing to do. And so that was really a big, you know, tipping off point for my parents to know that something was really, really wrong. So all day I wasn't moving, wasn't getting up, wasn't running around and playing, nothing. So my mom told my dad that night, if she isn't better by tomorrow, I'm taking her to the doctor. She looks worse. She looks terrible, you know, super lethargic. So we're going to go. So he comes home that night and it didn't go super well through the night, you know, just really, really sick baby. And so the morning of the 7th, it was around 9 a.m. My mom decided to, you know, my dad was at work and my mom decided that she was going to take me to the doctor. So it was just a little urgent care, you know, in our town, whatever. And so we went out and the doctor saw us, didn't even do an exam on me. The only thing he looked at was my throat. He opened up my mouth and immediately diagnosed me with strep throat and said, you know, we're going to give her a shot of antibiotics and we're going to send her on her way. She's going to be totally fine. Didn't do an exam, nothing. And so they didn't take a culture of my throat. And that was something that, you know, really kind of upset my mom. And looking back and talking about it, it still really upsets her. But they gave me the shot around 10 a.m. and I was on my way. So this also happened to be the day that my grandma and grandpa were getting ready to leave for a conference in Chicago. And my grandparents lived three or four doors down from us. And so we were always over at their house. You know, we've always been very close with them. And, you know, my grandma was really upset. And she, you know, both of them were really upset. But my grandma was saying that she did not want to go to the conference. She wasn't going to go. It just wasn't in the cards for her anymore. And it was just really, you know, out of character for me to be behaving this way. And so she wanted to stay behind and not go. But my mom, you know, she told him there's nothing you can do. She's seen the doctor. She got the shot. Don't worry. I'm just going to hold her. You know, everything's going to be fine. So they end up going. Grandparents are off to Chicago. And my mom decided to take me down to their house, which is just a few doors down. It was a little bit bigger, more open space for me to kind of run around and play if I wanted to. You know, they always had great furniture and great TVs. And, you know, so they were gone. And my mom decided to take me down there so we could be a little bit more comfortable. And so full disclosure, was fully naked at this time. The rash had gotten really bad. And so my mom really wanted to just kind of let my body air out and heal and not really have to worry about it and kind of just let it air out. And so I was, you know, I was walking around and, you know, I was still pretty lethargic at this point. So I sat there and I was laying on the couch and my mom was nursing Taylor in my grandpa's big recliner chair that was sitting right next to the couch. And it's funny because I look back, my grandparents have lived in that house for over 40 years. And you look back at pictures and the furniture is always in the exact same spot. They never move it. Grandma will try every 5 or 10 years and she'll try to rearrange it and it'll last maybe a day. She'll invite us over to come see the new furniture and how she rearranged it. And then she calls someone and, you know, they come back and rearrange it for her. And so she just doesn't like it. So it's always been in the same spot. And so I know exactly where we were at this time. And, you know, the kind of the TV in the middle and the furniture is on the outsides of the TV and it kind of makes a little U-type shape and it opens up into the kitchen and dining room area. But I was sitting on the couch and then my mom was sitting directly next to me. And so she was nursing my sister, and I told her that I said, "Mama, I want to hold you." And that was, it's funny because that is what all three of my, or all two of my sisters and I would tell someone if we wanted them to hold us. We would say, "I want to hold you." And so I told my mom, "I want to hold you." And so she said, "Okay, come over here." And I got up off the couch, and again, they were right next to each other. And so it was only about 3 or 4 feet. It was about 5 feet distance, but I only got about 3 feet. And then at this point, I fell down and passed out in between the couch and the chair. And I didn't like make a hard fall, but I kind of just slumped over and just fell asleep, just right there in the middle of the living room, just en route to my mom, fell over. And so at this point, she looked at me and she could see every bone in my back and my hips. And, you know, I was just skin and bones, and she could just see every little bone in my body. And they come to find out later that day, or the next day at the hospital when they would weigh me, I had lost 6 pounds. And for a 2-year-old, I mean, I'd love to lose 6 more pounds now, but for a 2-year-old, that's extremely dangerous. So when my mom saw this little lump of baby bones, she decided that is when it was time to go to the hospital. So she said, freaked out a little, and she called my grandma, who lived in Las Vegas, her mother. And my grandma, Las Vegas was only about an hour and a half from us. She was in massage therapy school. And so she called, my mom called my grandma and said, "Look, you really need to come down. We got to take the baby to the hospital. You know, she's not doing well at all." So then she called my dad. My dad was the second person. He was at work, and said, "You know, baby's getting worse. Looks horrible. You need to, as soon as you get home, we need to take her to the hospital." And so when I was talking with my mom about this, you know, her big thing was, "I don't know why I just didn't take you." In retrospect, why did I wait hours and hours till, you know, grandma got in from Vegas and dad got home from work? And she thinks, and this would make sense, you know, she had an infant. She had a 4-month-old. Then she had a sick 2-year-old. She was home alone. There was no family in town. My aunt lived in Denver at the time, so she wasn't around. You know, she's a young mom with 2 babies, and she said, quote, "I had no idea what the hell was going on." And so as soon as my dad came home, my grandma had arrived, and they decided to take me to the emergency room. So when they took me, at this point, I couldn't walk anymore. I couldn't even walk at all. So they had to carry me and hold me the entire time. And I was starting to have really labored breathing. And that hadn't been an issue for the longest time with my sickness. That was never something that they had seen. You know, I had had the diaper rash and I was really weak and whatnot, but never labored breathing. And so that was something that was really scary. And so they waited there in the emergency room for a good few hours. You know, my grandma was at home. It wasn't a smart idea to take a baby into the emergency room. And so grandma stayed home with Taylor, and they just waited for me to be able to go back and get some tests run. So they were really unsure, really scary moment. And so I'm going to pause right there, waiting to go back into the emergency room, and we're going to take a quick Bosco break, and we will be right back. You are listening to Real Life on Penguin Radio at radio.dominican.edu.
Here comes your weekly Bosco break. For 20 years, the heart transplant unit at Sydney's St. Vincent Hospital has been working hard to figure out a way to transplant a dead heart into a live patient. Doctors from the team announced their work had paid off. They have successfully completed 3 transplants using hearts that had stopped beating for 20 minutes, said to be the first such transplant in the world, according to the Sydney Morning Herald. 2 of the patients are already up and about, while the most recent recipient is still recovering in intensive care. Heart transplants typically rely on organs taken from brain-dead donors whose hearts are still beating. The Herald reports the new development could save 30% more lives. The surgeon who performed the surgeries says he kicked the air after he realized the first surgery had gone well. The secret to their success lies in cutting-edge technology and the preservation solution in which the non-beating hearts are immersed. The heart is first placed in a special heart-in-a-box machine that warms it up and keeps it beating for about 4 hours before the transplant operation. The preservation solution, which alone took 12 years to develop, minimizes damage to the organ after it has stopped beating and helps ensure it both survives the surgery and functions in the recipient's body. Michelle Gribelis, a 57-year-old woman who had congestive heart failure, tells the Herald that she was very sick before having the operation 2 months ago. And now, I'm a different person altogether. I feel like I'm 40 years old. In other recently fascinating discoveries, working along Russia's Volga River, archaeologists have discovered what's left of the 750-year-old city of Ukek, headed by the descendants of Genghis Khan. The researchers uncovered the city's Christian quarter, which was often visited by wealthy people. While some Christians were enslaved, the findings suggest that not all suffered that fate. The discovery includes a pair of Christian temples, one of which was built in 1280 and destroyed not long after. It was roofed with tiles and decorated with murals and stone carvings. The basement contained imported plates and bottles of Byzantine, Egyptian, or Iranian origin, the researcher notes. He also describes stone carvings from the temple, featuring images like a cross and a griffin clawing a lion. Ukek was founded by Batu Khan, a descendant of Genghis Khan. It was part of Batu's Golden Horde Kingdom, which reached from Europe to Central Asia. But the city was destroyed in the late 14th century in an attack by Tamerlane, a ruler who took control of a great deal of the Golden Horde's lands. That's the end of your Bosco break. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back. You just had a Bosco break here on Penguin Radio at radio.dominican.edu. I am DJ Homeschool, and we are here in the studio talking about my type 1 diabetes diagnosis. So we left off with me being in my hometown of Kingman at the emergency room with my mom and dad. And so we're going to jump right back in. And my mom and dad were sitting there with me, and they took me back and they needed to run some tests. So that was, of course, the first thing that they wanted to do. Well, the first thing was they wanted to run a blood test. Well, they didn't have a vein that they could get for me. My veins kept collapsing. And so they told my parents that they were going to have to do what they do to kids who can't find a vein. And so my parents were a little confused. You know, they thought, what in the world is going on? And they told them that they weren't going to be able to go back with me in this procedure, that it's something that they don't let parents be a part of. And so, you know, they're like, okay, well, how are you going to do this? They drilled a hole into my shin and had to draw blood from one of my bones. So that, when I was talking with my mom, she said, that is when I realized that I was going to pass out. And so luckily, she didn't hit the ground. Somebody was able to catch her and kind of, you know, take care of my mom. And she said she thinks it was my dad that caught her, but she's not 100% sure. So they don't let parents back. They end up, the doctors take me back in order to, you know, get this blood test in order to try and get some answers. So they took me back and they did their thing. And then they brought me out a little while later. We're not sure exactly how long it took, you know, not that long. So they brought me back out and, you know, I was in a hospital bed. And my mom says, I remember seeing you and you were so peaceful. And I thought, thank goodness she's finally sleeping. And she was able to sleep through that. Like, that is just incredible. So a long ways down the road, a long time later, months and months and months, they told her that is actually when I slipped into a diabetic coma. And so I was not in fact sleeping, but comatose. And so my dad was aware kind of what was going on, but they thought for the sake of my mom's sanity, you know, since they didn't have answers, they didn't have an explanation yet, they didn't know what was happening, they said, okay, look, we're just going to kind of let this one fly a little bit over her head. It's going to be okay. So they came back and got the results of the blood test, and it was one of three things. Hydrocephaly, which is water on the brain, which essentially you die. Spinal meningitis, again, I essentially would have died. And three, diabetes. And so at this point, this is what they were praying for. Diabetes, you live. You live with that. You make it work. You deal. And so that was what they were really, really hoping for. So, but what the problem now was that the KRMC, Kingman Regional Medical Center, they were not equipped to deal with something of this nature. You know, you have to remember, this was a long time ago. This was 18 years ago. Now, it'd be no problem. But they weren't prepared to deal with something like this. So they didn't have the facilities to run the tests. They didn't have a pediatric unit. And so they air vac'd me. They decided that they were going to air vac me to the Good Samaritan Hospital in Phoenix. And, you know, again, my grandparents were already on their way back from Chicago. And, you know, I've talked with my grandparents about this before, and I guess my grandma went into such a big panic that she has really bad claustrophobia, and so it really started to set in when she heard that I was really sick and in a coma, that she ran over to the window and was trying to get out the window, and my grandpa teases her now, like, what were you going to do, jump out the window? And luckily, you know, it was locked, and so she couldn't go anywhere, but it just kind of set in full panic mode for everybody involved. You know, at first I was, you know, as far as they knew, I was sleeping peacefully, and, you know, now I'm comatose and I'm being air vac'd. And so my mom went home to get the baby packed up, get Taylor packed up, and meet with my grandma, who was going to drive them down to Phoenix. And my dad was going to be the one who rode with me in the airplane. And so they drove me in an ambulance first to the airport, where they got me into this charter plane or whatever it was. And then they flew me down to the hospital. And when I was talking with my dad, you know, I said, what do you remember? What do you know? And he was like, I just remember everything had a haze over it. It was so hazy. I had no idea what was going on. He said it was so noisy and that I was out. There was nothing. I was not waking up through the noise. There was nothing they could do to wake me up. And I had in my little tiny leg, I had a vein or an IV stuck into my shin through this little hole that they had drilled, because my veins were still collapsing at this point. So they flew me down, and now this is in the middle of the night, and it's the early morning of May 8th, which is my diabetic anniversary. I have a little internal celebration, and my mom and I talk, you know, I talk to my mom every day, but we always have a nice little conversation on May 8th, and so that's a date that will always be, you know, very special to me. And I will forever be thankful to my mom and dad, you know, for catching this. But anyways, I got there at about 2:30 in the morning. And because it's a fairly long drive, it took my mom and grandma a little bit while longer to get there. They got there around 4:30 in the morning. And my mom said that the drive it was just awful. You know, it's a fairly simple drive now. It takes a long time, you know, 18 years later, but the roads are a little bit nicer. And so at first, you know, my grandma was driving too slow. And what are you doing? We have to get there. We have to see her. Why are you driving so slow? And then, you know, grandma would speed up, and then my mom would get mad at her again. Hey, you know, we got a baby in the car. What are you doing? I can't believe you would drive that fast. And so she said it was just constant yelling, but my grandma was a trooper. You know, she's a mom, and my grandma cares about nothing more than her kids and her grandkids. And so, you know, that's something that, you know, she endured, and she was panicking too, you know, having to make that drive and, you know, be with her young grandbaby. And so it was just a really emotional experience for everybody involved. So I got there at 2:00. Mom gets there at 4:30. And of course, I had been there for a while. And so they had already moved me into a room. So when my mom got there, she said that my grandma dropped her off at the front through the emergency room. And of course, it's dark and it's the middle of the night. And my mom was running through the hospital. And my mom's a runner. And so she says, when I say I was running, I was running. I was not jogging. I was not briskly walking. I was running through that hospital. And she said it was like a movie where, you know, it's the long, dark hallways, and it was just completely vacant. No one was there on the pediatric floor, and so dark, all the lights were out, and she just kept running. She said, I felt like I was just running in circles and circles and circles and going down hallways, and I couldn't find anybody. I couldn't find a living person. And so she was just running around, just screaming like a crazy person. And so finally she found somebody, and, you know, my grandma was able to park the car and get my little sister out and, you know, find me where I was now in the hospital room. So she meets with the doctors, and this is all, obviously she wasn't there, so this was just being relayed to her by my dad and the doctors. So what happened was, when I got there, I went through the emergency room doors, and a doctor that wasn't even supposed to be on my service, and he didn't actually even work at that hospital. He was just a visiting ER physician. And so when they brought me in, he took one look at me, and he knew exactly what was wrong with me. So this is a little bit crazy. He was diabetic himself. And so he was able to recognize these symptoms of diabetes and said, I don't want you guys. He told, you know, the doctors, don't waste any more time. He said, this baby has minutes to live. You have to get her on a very slow insulin drip right now. So they did that. And they had to put it in my arm. You can't put it into your shin. And so they were going to have to put an IV in. And so here's a part of this story that I really debated telling. And this is what I was talking with Bella about last night. You know, I thought, I'm not sure if I want to share this part, you know, on the radio with everybody. But I think that it's important because it's a huge part of my diabetic journey and my great relationship with my parents and just how connected we always have been and still are. But while my mom, you know, again, she wasn't there at the hospital with me for those first couple hours because the drive to Phoenix is about 4 hours long. And so she was in the car, and she said, all of a sudden I got this really weird pain in my arm, and I didn't know why. It was this sharp, but like dull, aching, hurting pain. And she grabbed her arm and she said, you know, if I hadn't have been with grandma, and my grandma can vouch for her, I would have thought I was losing my marbles. That's what my mom says. I was losing my marbles. But she got this horrible pain in her arm. And, you know, she thought, okay, that's really weird, but didn't think anything of it. So now fast forward a couple hours, she sees me laying in that hospital bed. And I don't have the shin IV anymore. I have a huge IV with a drip on my arm. And so they asked, you know, when did you put that in? You know, my mom and my grandma are sitting there looking at each other like, okay, this is really weird. They said, right when she got in, about 2 a.m. And so, you know, I've heard of that happening before, of people that have a really deep connection being able to kind of feel each other's pain. And, you know, I was talking with Bella about this, and she knew a brother and sister, and one of them, they were at the same elementary school, and the brother was outside and broke his arm. He fell off something in the playground, and the little girl was at the same school, but in her classroom, she didn't have the same recess, and was grabbing her arm, screaming, crying that she was in pain before she even knew that her little brother had broken his arm. And so I just think that that is amazing, just phenomenon. And I just thought it was absolutely incredible that, you know, there I was having to find a vein, a viable vein, while I was in a coma in a little baby arm. And my mom felt that too. And so that's something that's always just been absolutely amazing to me. And so I kind of wanted to share that with you. So the doctor started me on an insulin drip, and he said, you know, this baby has minutes to live, and so you need to do this, though. You need to do it slowly. And the reason for that is because they knew that I was in a coma. And what happens when you are in a coma is that your brain swells. And if you bring someone out of a coma, their brain will shrink. But if you do it too quickly, the shrinking and the swelling is really painful. They said it's like the most intense, awful headache that you've ever had. And so they said they don't really have it, and it can also lead to brain damage, the shrinking and swelling. So one, they had to do it slowly, but I was so sick, they weren't sure that I was going to make it out. So they're telling my parents this, you know, they're standing there and they're saying, you know, we're not exactly sure. We just have to wait and see, you know, we've got her on an insulin drip. We're just going to have to wait. And right then is when I decided it was time to wake up and I opened my eyes. And so that right there was the start of this whole new journey of my life and my life with diabetes. And my blood sugar, they checked it, and I was over 800. And, you know, blood sugar monitors, you know, finger pokes is what I call them, they don't even register that high. Some of them don't measure over 500, but none of them measure over 600 unless you go to a hospital. So I was 836, and it's just a daily reminder when I check my blood sugar of how lucky I am to be in control and have these great blood sugars and be able to micromanage my life. And so I stayed in the hospital, and I was just from day one surrounded by amazing people that were there to support me. My mom's college roommate, Joy, she was there. Joy was in my mom's wedding. She came to see me. Both of my grandparents were there. One of my mom's friends, Krista, from her playgroup was there. My grandpa, who lived down in Casa Grande, which is southern Arizona, he came down and brought his mom, my great-grandma Violet. And of course, my mom and dad were there with me every day. You know, I'm pretty sure my Aunt Julie came down as well. And so I was just always surrounded by this amazing support group, this team of people. And so everyone was there by that night. So the evening of the 8th is when I started to kind of, you know, wake up from my groggy haze and just be ready to go and just start this new area of my life. And so I was there for about a week, and one thing my mom remembers is she said how much I hated being in the crib. You know, I was still in the pediatric unit, and I was so little that they made me sleep in a crib with metal bars, and I had to sleep with them up. And she said it was awful that I looked like I was in baby jail. And so they started training with these people, with the diabetic educators and the doctors. And I've seen so many different diabetic educators throughout the years. And I've had some amazing ones and I've had some not so good ones. And my mom says this was the worst diabetic educator in the history of the world. She said that the minute we sat down, she said, tell your daughter to say goodbye to cookies. She'll never eat another cookie again. Tell her that she can never go to birthday parties again because they won't be able to monitor her blood sugars. And her life as she knows it is over. And so that is extremely scary that someone would tell you that. And that's just like the worst thing you could tell your child. You know, this is your brand new, it's your first baby, it's your little girl, to tell her she'll never be able to have a cookie again, never go to a birthday party, never have sleepovers. You know, it was all of these things. And, you know, of course we found out that that was not true. And these people really tried to instill a sense of fear into my mom and dad. But luckily, they went beyond that and they did more research and found better doctors and found this great team of diabetic educators and endocrinologists and nurses that were able to take on my care and to really train them and teach them exactly how to live with diabetes and that it is a fully livable condition. I am 100% able to go to birthday parties. I had so many sleepovers, and believe me, I love cookies. That is something that I always have loved, and so I am able to have that, and this is a fully livable disease. But of course, my parents were so scared to take me home. You know, they said, you know, every parent, new parent has that fear of, oh my God, I might kill my baby. You know, I don't know how to, you know, what if something goes wrong? But this is more serious. You know, diabetes was even more serious. And it brought on a whole new element to their care for their baby. And, you know, there was all of this balance. And, you know, at that point, they said nothing else mattered except the care of Taylor and I. And so they were already, you know, they already had that mindset. They had already had that switch of this is our life now. This is what we have to do. And we're going to make it work. And we're going to make it great. And they did. They made my life absolutely amazing. I never had to go. I never felt like I was cheated out of anything. You know, of course, there were those times that, you know, my blood sugar was high, and so I couldn't eat what I wanted when I wanted to, or my blood sugar was low, and I would have to force down some juice and some glucose tablets, and that, you know, really upset me if I didn't want it. But they always made my life, they tried to make my life as normal as possible. And so they spent this week in the hospital, and then they, you know, decided it was time, they took me home. So they didn't do a whole lot of anything for a while, you know, and that wasn't a whole lot different from what their life was like before, because they had a brand new infant baby. So, you know, you're tired and, you know, you don't have a lot of energy to do a lot of things. But they also, you know, my parents felt bad for me as a little girl, and they felt bad that I did have to live with this disease. And as much as they tried to normalize my life, sometimes that's just not all the way possible. And so, you know, I got a lot of toys, you know, they would try and make it up to me. And, you know, I got away with a little bit more than a normal toddler would be able to get away with due to mood swings. You know, that was something that I battled, and I still battle them when my blood sugars are not right. You feel awful. And the doctors had tried to explain that to my parents and say, you know, she's going to feel A, B, C, and then when she's low, she'll feel X, Y, Z. And it's hard to understand that, to understand how someone else is feeling when you don't get to experience that. It's not like you can say, oh, your baby has the flu, she feels horrible, and you're like, oh yeah, I know what that feels like. You don't. That is why you don't have diabetes. You don't know what that feels like. And your body regulates your blood sugars manually or automatically, and we have to do mine manually. And so that was something that they kind of struggled with, but they did a really good job to really kind of normalize my life. And the doctors always told my parents that it would be a blessing that I got diagnosed at the age that I did. And of course, that kind of irritated them. My mom thought, why would you say that? Why is that a blessing? And, you know, why is that a good thing? And it's because I wouldn't have to relearn my lifestyle. You know, I'm sure if you talk to my aunt that it was one of the most difficult things she's ever done is having to relearn her lifestyle with diabetes. And, you know, you have eating habits, you have exercise habits, and you have whatever other habits you may have that you're not used to accounting for. And so when you're little, it's kind of automatic. You know, yes, my mom and dad had to really make sacrifices and they had to micromanage my life. But they did that in a sense anyways. They've always been really health conscious and healthy people. And so they always had, you know, practiced, you know, healthy habits with my sister and I. But this was just one step further. And so they said it would be great because I wouldn't have to relearn that when I was, you know, 12 and 13 years old. And so I grew up micromanaging. And, you know, that was something that has kind of fallen back over the years. And then again, you know, you kind of get off track and then you just pick right back up and you start micromanaging again. And I'm able to have these amazing blood sugars and play golf and be a nanny and not have to worry about going into a coma in the middle of the night. I don't ever have to worry about passing out when I drive because I'm really in tune with my body and I'm able to feel when I have those low blood sugars. You know, of course, there are those times where, you know, I'm like, oh, you know, my friends are really like attuned to me. And so if I'm kind of acting funky, you know, there's those, you know, mood swings when you're not feeling well, when your body just is going through a blood sugar change, you know, it doesn't always make you in the best of moods, especially when you're low, you get really shaky And when you're low, your brain doesn't get oxygen, so you're not thinking clearly. And so I cry sometimes. I mean, I cry anyways. I'm a big fan of crying. I think it's really healthy. But, you know, I start crying sometimes if I'm low, if I don't realize that I'm going low. But luckily, I have amazing friends who are like, hey, dude, you're acting really funky. Like, go check your blood sugar. You know, they know, and they're respectful of that. And so, you know, there are those times where it sucks. You know, I want to go out and I want to, like, go to dinner with my friends, or, you know, I want to go have boba or whatever it is, and my blood sugar's high, and I'm like, what the heck? Like, I ate really well today, I gave all my insulin today, you know, what is going on? Why is my blood sugar high? But that's the name of the game. Like, that is diabetes, right? It's this balancing act, and sometimes things get off balance. But I feel really lucky because I have learned so much about health and nutrition and lifestyle through diabetes and through my journey as a type 1. And, you know, I've been on an insulin pump, and then I've went back to injections, which I'm currently on. And, you know, my parents fought for me to get an insulin pump when I was a young kid. My doctor wasn't going to put me on one. And so they changed doctors and they went to an entirely new state to get me a pump. And so all of the time, I am surrounded by my team. And that's something that my mom and dad still stress to me. When my blood sugars are good and when my blood sugars are bad, we are a team. And I know that no matter what, I can rely on them and fall back on them and have that support system. Whether I'm in Kingman or San Francisco, it doesn't matter. You know, getting a grip on diabetes was so tough, and it still is a challenge, you know, every day, but it's made me a better person. I am able to educate others. I am able to talk to you guys about it on my radio show, and this is a livable, manageable disease, and I've learned to make do with what I have. And the healthcare condition that I am in, you know, I work out, I eat healthy, and I take these strides to ensure that I live a really long, healthy life and hopefully can influence somebody else with diabetes or without diabetes, and just encourage them to, no matter what it is, take control, whether it's of their health or a really tough class that they're in. That's something that I hope I am able to relay to you today. And what I want everybody to take away from this is that diabetes is not a death sentence. It's manageable. And I understand that this condition is not my fault. My mom didn't let me eat too many cookies. I didn't drink chocolate milk. You know, these are all crazy things that people have said to me. And I think the JDRF puts it very eloquently. And they say, this is a quote, "While its causes are not yet entirely understood, scientists believe that environmental triggers are involved. Its onset has nothing to do with diet or lifestyle. There is nothing you can do to prevent T1D, and at present, nothing you can do to get rid of it." And, you know, while I may not be able to rid my body of this chronic disease, I have an amazing life. I am an honor student. I'm on a collegiate golf team. I'm a nanny of twins, and, you know, one of them is diabetic, and I have my condition under tight control. I carry around giant purses that are stuffed full of juice boxes and glucose tablets and granola bars and apples. You know, I give myself insulin shots in public with no shame. And my floor and my car and even my friends' cars, they're littered with those teeny little test strips and, you know, the shot wrappers. And, you know, I really leave my mark wherever I go. And it's because I know no other way to live, and this is truly my reality, and I love it. It's great. And I want to thank you guys for listening with me today and being a part of my diabetic journey for a little point in time. And I encourage any of you, I know that we have some diabetics on campus, and if any of you see me or know who I am, stop me, ask questions, or if you just need to talk about it, you know, great. Talk to me. Let me know. I'm always here. This is something that I'm completely passionate about and completely love. And, you know, type 1 diabetes is a really great way to shape community. And that's something that I have seen and hope to continue to see here in my life and in my life at school. So I hope everybody has a great rest of their day. You just listened to a special episode of Real Life on radio.dominican.edu. Enjoy the rest of your day.